Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers, and if you're out there across America, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because, of course, we have one of our special friends on the program this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, Dr. Cuddy's written a number of books, Secret Records Revealed, The Globalist, Now is the Dawning, The Road to Socialism, NEA Power Grab, Timeline to the New World Order, having to do with education, and of course his book 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge, and then of course his latest book Cover Up. And we actually carry all of the books we're talking about. They're all available through my ministry if you want more information. But of course Cover Up is a fascinating book because it just goes into really what's going on today, what happened on September 11th. Did we see what we really thought we saw on November 11th? Did we see what we thought we saw during the attack on Iraq? And so also to let Dr. Cuddy pick up the story from there. Because, you know, as we start our program with so often, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And our concepts, our belief, our reality is created by what we see on television, but is what we see on television really true? Are we being victims of a propaganda campaign, which by repetition, and of course the repetition and repetition begins to create a reality that really isn't there? Well, Dr. Cuddy, you pick up the story.
Well, you're absolutely right. Both situations that I cover in my book, September 11th and the war with Iraq, are now under some scrutiny. Regarding September 11th, U.S. Senator Bob Graham, who's also a presidential candidate, has called what's going on a cover-up, which happens to be the title of my book. And regarding Iraq, of course, they're looking especially into the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam was supposed to have. And so basically what I've done is picked up from the information that I had in my book, which is a follow-up to the September 11 Prior Knowledge book, and I try to do several things. I put as much as possible the quotations by the people involved, whether it's the book Secret Records Revealed or the latest two, in their own words, so you'll find it's heavy with documentation, so no one has to take my word for anything. They can look up these quotations and the facts and check them out for themselves. And what I try to do also is look into the future, because if any of your listeners are familiar with my books, I've gone into previous works talking about a conspiracy. Cecil Rhodes has planned to take over the world, and other avenues, the Fabian Socialist and others. And so if there is this, as I call them, power elite, I try and anticipate what would happen. And so prior to September 11th, I had both in my Secret Records book and the Globalist book that the public could be conditioned in the future through perhaps a terrorist attack to accept limitations or give up certain of their freedoms in order to have peace and security. And sure enough, September 11th happens, and that very afternoon, ABC Washington Post comes out with a poll saying two-thirds of the public would be willing to do just that. And same thing with Iraq. The book Cover-Up came out just prior, immediately prior to the initiation of the conflict itself. And so in that book, I said there's basically two possibilities if conflict comes about, and that is, first, if it's a staged war, it will be over relatively soon with relatively few casualties, even from weapons of mass destruction. And the reason I could make that sort of forecast or prediction is I said if it were a real war, something entirely different would happen. You could count on Saddam using his weapons of mass destruction, which Colin Powell said he had tons of. He said he had 25,000 liters of anthrax and 100 to 500 tons of other chemical weapons. You could count on him launching his Scud or Al-Samud missiles at Israel, because he did that during the Gulf War. Surely now, when his life is at stake, he would do that. Surely also, I said, in a real war, he would have his agents, Iraqi agents in this country, do some rather simple terrorist attacks that wouldn't even entail committing suicide. They could derail passenger trains, many other things, none of which they did. They didn't torch the oil fields. They didn't destroy the bridges that we had to cross in Iraq to move from Kuwait to Baghdad. They didn't clog the Euphrates River. They didn't destroy the highway. They didn't destroy the airfield. They didn't do any number of things that would have happened in a real war. So given that, it's easy to see why there's a lot of looking at what went on both in September 11th and in the war with Iraq.
And so what one of the things I've always considered, Dr. Cuddy, is, look, this is a real war. And they've got 125 sophisticated fighter planes. Certainly, they would be no match for ours, but they have all these fighter planes, and they could put them in the air and strafed our troops. And then, of course, flown them off some other place so they wouldn't be blasted out of the air by our planes. But they didn't do that. I mean, did you hear about any attacks on our troops from Saddam's Air Force? Or Saddam had helicopters. We know he had them because we let him put them in the air and, of course, slaughter the people both in southern and northern Iraq who rose up against him back in 1991 after President George Herbert Walker Bush said to the people of Iraq, rise up, overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we'll come and help you. And they rose up because they believed the president, and he not only refused to help them, he let Saddam put his helicopter gunships in the air and slaughter the people. Though, why didn't they use those helicopter gunships against our forces? Did you hear about the helicopter gunships against our forces? And there weren't any. And so I can only ask the question, are they saving those for the next war, or what's the truth of the matter? And what Dr. Cuddy points out is very true. The Iraqi military just really just sort of disappears. The Republican Guard, ready to fight to the death for a fatherland, and Saddam Hussein is told to retreat north of Baghdad, where they're told simply to take off the uniforms and go home. So there's something wrong with this entire scenario, because certainly Don Rumsfeld, in opposition to all of his generals, said, we're not going to need very many men. And the general said, we need overwhelming superiority, and we need at least another 100,000 men. And it was either Donald Rumsfeld is the smartest military technician in the whole entire world, or he knew that this was going to be a phony war.
Well, picking up on exactly that, what I found fascinating was not only the helicopter gunships, which could have easily gone while our troops were amassed just over the border in Kuwait, where we were in a nice little pile where they could have attacked us, as could their Air Force, because their Air Force probably could have gotten there just as fast as our Air Force, as we were far, far away, having to launch off of carriers, and we couldn't even fly over Turkey and so on. But in addition to that, if you do have weapons of mass destruction, once again, there's nothing to prevent Saddam from acting preemptively himself. And there we were, amassed just the other side of the Kuwait border, the perfect spot to have his weapons of mass destruction, maybe, you know, in one of those airplanes or helicopter gunships in sort of a suicide mission or whatever. Same thing with the tanks. Some of our generals over there, when they went up on the way to Baghdad, they said, well, where are all the tanks? We heard about 1,000 tanks. We haven't, you know, destroyed 1,000 tanks. Where are they? Then you have the 15,000 individuals who are his elite forces right around him, another 100,000 Republican Guard, another 200,000 regular army. Well, we didn't kill, you know, 300,000 people or take 300,000 prisoners. So, again, those individuals sort of faded away. But one of the other things, we keep hearing these various excuses. For example, when the reason for, well, he didn't launch his Scud missiles or any missiles against Israel, we're told by George Will, for example, well, you know, our special ops people, they were in the ground early on and over there. Well, you know, unfortunately, a lot of listeners say, okay, that makes sense to me, and the matter isn't pursued. But you have to remember, this is prior to the actual beginning of conflict. It is one of the most pre-announced wars in history. They had like 3 months of inspectors, 3 months before another report. Even at the end, President Bush gave Saddam and his sons 48 hours to abdicate or whatever. The point is, the deadlines were very well known. There was plenty of time for Saddam to act preemptively himself. So we're supposed to believe, as he's transporting all of these mobile Scuds and Al Samuds out to the West to launch against Israel, let's say, you know, maybe 100 of them. He launched 49 during the Gulf War. Okay, let's say he's got 100 now. And he's putting them out there in these mobile carriers to launch against Israel, And we're supposed to believe that we had enough special forces stationary in various locations, because they couldn't move around. If they moved around, the Iraqis would have spotted them. So they're stationary, and all 100 of these are supposed to go out there and go right to where our special forces are, so our special forces can kill all of the Iraqis, so none of them can make it back to Saddam and say, guess what, Saddam, there's special forces out there, even though the U.S. has said you got 48 hours to abdicate before any conflict begins. Now, when you start following the illogic of those types of excuses for why he didn't use them, you see how desperate the situation is. And so that's when I tried to ask Newsweek and these other people a sort of series of questions, because if the average person calls them up, for example, when they said about September 11th, I asked them about the top Pentagon officials on September 10th suddenly canceling their travel plans for the next morning because of security concerns, their sort of off-the-cuff answer that I imagine they give anybody would be, oh, well, Congress has investigated, and they didn't find anything, and so we don't believe in conspiracy theories, and that's the end of that.
Well, now, before our listeners out there, before we get into that, let me just point out that Dr. Cuddy is talking about articles that appeared in Newsweek magazine on both the 13th of September of the year 2001, that's, what, 2 days after the attack, and then on the 24th of September, which was, what, about 13 days after the attack. And in both of those articles, why the Newsweek magazine writers said that high Pentagon officials had actually canceled their planned flights for September 11th on the 10th of September. In other words, the day before the September 11th attack, highly placed Pentagon officials canceled their flights for the 11th of September, which would suggest that they at least suspected something was going to happen. So you cautiously called the people there at Newsweek and asked them about the articles, the people who wrote the articles. What was their response?
Well, there's 2 points. I called one of the reporters and asked him if he found out who the top Pentagon official were. He said no, and I said, well, did you not ask who they were? Did you ask? And they refused to tell you. And he said, quote, I don't want to talk about it anymore, end quote. So I called the head of the Washington Bureau, Evan Thomas, who also just happens to be the co-author of a book called The Wise Men on the Power of 6 CFR members. And so Evan Thomas is head of the Bureau, and he starts giving me this routine about, as I said, Congress has investigated, and surely they would have turned up something, and I don't believe in conspiracy theories. And so that was supposed to be, as far as he was concerned, the end of that. But I pressed further. I said, well, you know, Mayor Willie Brown on September 10th, also late at night, not a routine call, got a late-night call from security people saying that he and all Americans should watch their air travel because Willie Brown was supposed to fly the morning of the 11th, from San Francisco to New York City. And I said he either got the call or he didn't, and Evan Thomas just reiterated he doesn't believe in conspiracy theories, and that was supposed to be the end of that. But what your listeners have to remember is, These people are in sort of a, backing off denial mode, whatever, for whatever reason. And you really can't just look at them and accept what they say on face value for this reason. Newsweek claims to be a very, prestigious, entity. And they're not going to publish anything on, the 13th of September that accuses top Pentagon officials of having foreknowledge unless they've checked it, rechecked it. The 2-3 sources, managing editors, everybody has looked at it and is absolutely dead sure that they're right. But let's assume that for some reason this is a 1-in-a-million mistake and they got it wrong. Let's also, we can conclude that the next day after this appears, somebody at the Pentagon calls them up and says, you people are nuts for printing that. There's absolutely no truth to it. Now, if they did that, surely by the 24th, they would have verified it again and come back and said it's right, or they would have forgotten about it. But here they are on the 24th with Evan Thomas's own name on this article this time, saying exactly the same thing, that on the 10th of September, some top Pentagon officials suddenly, they use that word, suddenly canceled their travel plans for the next morning because of security concerns. So we have to assume there's something there. And so that's why I encourage your listeners, it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, even if you're a loyal supporter of President Bush, we need to not give anybody, any political figure, the ability to avoid questions. If you don't want to make an accusation, that's your business. The point is, we at least need to know the answers to these questions, because for all we know, there could be an attack in the near future. We need to know if there are contingency plans, if there's some sort of airline hijacking next week that would fly into the tallest building in Los Angeles or wherever. So we need to demand answers to these questions, and we cannot be put off by these evasions, whether it's by Newsweek or by government officials.
Well, I think that somebody has put tremendous pressure onto people, within the news media, and certainly you talk in your book, and so much of this is covered in Dr. Cuddy's excellent book, Cover Up, and if you haven't got it, you really should. One of the things you mentioned, of course, is Bill Gertz. Now, for our listeners who don't know, Bill Gertz is really one of the most outstanding reporters, or best-known reporters from the Washington Times, and he always gets inside information, and you have to understand that question. How did you get this inside information? Somebody in the CIA or the government must be leaking this information to him. But, of course, you talk about Operation Bajanka and, of course, Bill Gertz. Would you like to pick up that story?
Sure. It's very similar to what happened with Newsweek. A couple of months prior to the attacks of September 11th, Bill Gertz put out what he calls a backgrounder. And it's picked up by various people, in this case, Northwest Airlines, the flight attendants, magazines, and things like that. And in there, in Project Bojinka, his description of it is that this was a project, the sort of fallback plan of Ramzi Youssef and the others who were masterminding the 1993 World Trade Center, the first bombing. And they had discovered later, and in the Philippines, they get the laptop of Abdul Hakim Murad, his sort of right-hand man, and in the computer that they decipher, the first plan is that they would hijack airliners and, you know, they would be exploded over the Pacific or Atlantic, wherever. And then the fallback position or second level is that they would hijack airliners and they would fly them specifically into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the Sears Tower, in Chicago, in the Transamerica building in San Francisco.
Oh, the Pentagon, right.
Right, and I emphasize that Transamerica, because, you know, San Francisco is where Willie Brown was, so maybe that's why he got the call. And so this is 2 months in advance. Then, sure enough, September 11th happens, and shortly thereafter, Bill Gertz comes out with his book, Breakdown, but in there, he's only talking about one of the buildings being flown into, just like the Washington Post did.
Now, in other words, he's talking about Operation Bajanka, which was what this was all about. But when he talks about Operation Bajanka, which he'd written about 2 months before the September 11th attack, and we have that article, if any of you would like to see it, you just give us a call and ask us for it, and we'll send it. But, you know, here he's writing about Operation Bajanka, and he forgets about what he'd written 2 months beforehand, or he says he's forgotten, where they talk about the flying the buildings, the planes into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, I believe it was the White House, the Sears building, and the building there in Chicago. But who know the Transamerica building in San Francisco, the Sears Tower in Chicago. Bill Gertz has completely forgotten that, and we're going to cover that when we get back here after the break. In other words, why would Bill Gertz forget what he'd written? I know Dr. Cuddy talked to him, and he puts in the book how he talked to Bill Gertz, and Bill Gertz couldn't remember what he'd written, and we have it. And when I asked him about it, he said, oh, I was wrong. I never should have written it. It wasn't going to happen. But, Bill, it did happen. How could that be? Well, somebody's putting pressure on. We'll talk about this in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Why don't you pick up the story of Operation Bajanka, Bill Gertz, and what was your response from Bill Gertz when you asked him about why he left out of his book, Breakdown, which came out within the last 6 months, what he had written about 2 months before the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th? He had one of the greatest scoops of all time, didn't he?
Absolutely, he really did. But when I asked him about it, he said, "Oh, well, that was just a mistake." And so that's one reason why in my book Cover Up, I actually put the quotation by the individual in the Philippines. His name was Rafael Garcia, who was head of the computer company that did the deciphering for the Philippine government. And in there, Garcia says, "Oh, yes, those were all specifically mentioned: the Transamerica building, Sears Tower, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, and so on. Those were actually part of Project Bojinka." So as you just said, Bill, you got it right. How come you're not claiming credit for this now?
I had the most interesting discussion the other night, a couple of nights ago, with Colonel Buzz Patterson, who was with Clinton in 1996 after the time of the TWA bombing, attack on our TWA 800 that went down off the coast of Long Island. But he was saying that in 1996, why right after the TWA 800 went down, Bill Clinton was asking about Operation Bajinkum. And he had on his desk, and of course, Colonel Patterson was with him all the time, because he was carrying the nuclear football, as they call it, the means by which, of course, the president would launch a counterattack if we were attacked by Soviet nuclear weapons. And, of course, that right there on the desk was all about Operation Bajinkum and everything it involved. So Bill Clinton knew about it in 1996. Bill Gertz knew about it 2 months before the September 11th attack, but he doesn't know about it now. So obviously we're not getting the truth. I think that's a fair statement, isn't it?
Yes, and picking up on what you just said, we in the American public was not aware that on that particular date that TWA 800 was shot down, that we were on the highest state of alert that we had been in many, many years, and that's because we had information that a terrorist group was about to launch an attack. And so, again, in my cover-up book, I put the specifics of that. Josef Bodansky, who was director of the U.S. House of Representatives Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, had written a couple of books, and he specifically refers to the downing of TW-800 as a terrorist attack. And then later, Bodansky went into some rather specific details how, and following up that a new book out by Cashel and Sanders, indicating that what exactly happened, that there really was a group, that an Islamic group that claimed, quote, credit for that, but the American public has just told that it was some sort of mechanical failure, and that story is alive today as far as most people are concerned when it's not true.
Well, of course, the important thing is that if you'd read the European papers in England and on the continent, why the Islamists took full credit for downing of TW-800, but because of the degree of control that exists over the American media, the American people were never allowed to hear that. I mean, that is the most incredible thing. Almost 200 people who saw the missiles go up and hit TW-800, and yet not one of those people was ever interviewed on major television, and none of them were allowed to testify before the House Committee, if it's the National Traffic Safety Board, NTSB, hearings. We do have, of course, videos of those in something called Silence, and I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. We're talking about his book entitled Cover Up. And if you haven't read it, it's well worthwhile getting. If you want to know anything more, you might give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But of course, one of our listeners up in the Great Northwest weren't listening to us. We were talking about the shooting down of TW-800 and the fact that the Islamic radicals in Europe had notified the papers over there, we shot down TW-800. And not a word of that ever got into the American media. And, of course, there were over 200 people, or almost 200 people, who saw the missiles go up and hit the plane. And, of course, none of them was ever interviewed by the major media here in the United States. And then, of course, when they had the NTSB hearings, the National Traffic Safety Board hearings, why, of course, government officials got up and lied and said, here's what the witnesses said. And then, of course, Jack Cashel, in this wonderful video which we have called Silence, actually interviews the witnesses, and you can hear what they've really said. They simply lied to the American people. They lied on television. Unfortunately, C-SPAN actually had that tape available. We have it. And, of course, you'll see it on the video, Silence. And it's the most incredible story. How could it be if the Islamic radicals said, we shot down your plane, that nobody in America ever heard that? You could only occur if somebody controls what the American people think.
Well, that's part of the plan. Just briefly, just for a few seconds, because I want to, you know, as you are describing this, to stick to the subject, but I'll just briefly mention that in my previous books, Secret Records Reveal the Globalists, I explain how, whether it's Cecil Rhodes or J.P. Morgan, That literally was part of their plan to buy up. Originally, J.P. Morgan wanted to buy up 200 papers, but his group got together and decided if they could buy up 25 of them, the leading 25, from which the other daily newspapers around the country got their information. If you look at your hometown newspaper, it'll probably say, you know, New York Times or L.A. Times or from one of the major ones. If they could just control these major news outlets, then they could control not only what you did read, but what you did not learn as well. And that was part of Cecil Rhodes's plan as well. Moving up to the current situation, what I'm trying to do now is figure out, because I know there are a lot of people who are supporters of the current administration, President Bush. And what I try to do is present a question to these individuals and look at it this way. Let's assume that President Bush is as pure as the driven snow, and let's assume a lot of really, really positive things. My problem is there should still be some outrage and some really tough demands by the population, including Republicans and conservatives, regarding this issue. Let me do this real quick. Let's assume that these top Pentagon officials are sitting around and one of these NSA intercepts comes through, and let's assume that it's not specific. Let's say, well, an attack could occur this week and maybe it's a hijacking. And so they say, well, you know, this week hijacking, maybe we better cancel our plans. And then they say, well, do we tell the public? And they said, well, you know, if we knew for sure it was Tuesday morning, but what if it's Wednesday morning? You know, we don't want to create a panic and so on. And then somebody says, well, suppose it is a hijacking. We've had hijackings in the past. You know, somebody wants to fly the plane to Cuba until we release their friends up in New York from the first World Trade Center bombing. And so on. So basically they decide not to say anything. The problem with that is, it's sort of the Dick Cheney syndrome, where he said, well, we knew something big and soon was going to happen. We just didn't have the specifics. My problem with that is twofold. Number one, where's the preventive contingency planning if you know something big and soon is going to happen? Where's the military helicopter on standby alert just in case there might be a plane flown into the Transamerica building or World Trade Center or wherever? That was totally ignored. There's other problems, too, with where were the fighter jets, you know, once the attack was underway. The second thing is what Kristen Breitwiser said. If her husband, who was killed when the second tower fell because they hadn't evacuated, if they had just known there might have been a terrorist attack, then when that first plane hit, all of those people who died in the second tower probably could have been saved because they would have immediately evacuated that building thinking this might be the attack we were warned about. So even if one is a big supporter of President Bush, we still need to have these questions answered.
I agree with you totally. Well, we're going to have to take a break here at the half hour. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, why worry about that? That's in the past. Well, if there are wicked people, I'm not saying who they are, but if there are wicked people who would deceive us about what happened on September 11th, if there were people who even suspected there was going to be an attack and did nothing at all to warn the American people, if there were people who suspected there was going to be an attack and yet orders were given over the loudspeaker in the South Tower of the World Trade Center, don't get up, don't move, stay at your positions, there's nothing to worry about, ignore what's happening on the North Tower, an awful lot of lives would have been saved, and they weren't, and we need an independent investigation. We're not getting it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and Dr. Cuddy has taught at the university level. He was in the Reagan Department of Education when Ronald Reagan was president, and certainly, in my estimation, he's one of the finest researchers we have, going into the background of what's going on today. And we're talking right now about his book, Cover-Up. But, of course, we carry all the other books, September 11th, Prior Knowledge. And, of course, there's just so much information there that you need to have to understand what's going on. The most amazing article in the latest Insight magazine, Dr. Cuddy, I don't know if you've seen it or if you'd like me to send it to you, but basically it's talking about the fact that at least six of the hijackers that the FBI says were on those planes are alive and well. They're living over in the Near East. And, of course, it goes into the background of how why the FBI within 24, I guess within 2 days, that would be 48 hours of the attack, was able to go on television and said, these are the 19 people. We know who they were. And then they said, well, how did we know? Well, we knew this from interviews. Well, who did they interview? Did they interview the people on the planes? And then, of course, and then they mentioned, well, we knew it from the passports. The passports, which were found adjacent to the planes, and you know, as I'm reading this, well, we did this from interviews, we did it from telephone conversations, we did it from the ledgers, the airport security people, and the passports that were found adjacent to the crash sites. Now, you know, I'm reading this in Insight magazine. The passports they found adjacent to the crash sites. Would you like to pick up that subject? Because if there is one thing that should make every American concerned about what we've been told, it's the fact that somehow the hijackers were able to roll down the planes on the windows on the planes and throw their passports out so that they would drift to the ground adjacent to the crash sites so that, well, maybe so their family would know what had happened to them. Would you like to pick up that story?
Okay. Basically, there are several issues involved, and they all revolve around what we knew in advance, but maybe we're not saying. For example, on the passports, well, on the six hijackers, since you brought that up first, originally the Pentagon, Defense Department, and others said, yes, we've quickly, which is strange, quickly identified all of these 19 individuals. We know all about them. Later on, the story came out that about six or so really were alive, and maybe they had their passport stolen. But recently, within the past week or so, the Pentagon and Defense Department are now back to their original story. Oh, no, we got it right the first time, which is the same sort of scenario, which if we have time, we can get into about whether we got Saddam the first time or the second time. And if we got him, you know, the first time, why were we saying we got him the second time?
And of course, but how could they find the passports
right
of these people? You know, here you have these firing infernos where these planes crash. You saw the pictures
right
of what happened when the planes crashed into the North Tower and the second and the South Tower, and then of course we were told in Pennsylvania the plane nosedives down into the ground, and all that's left there is a big pit and absolutely nothing. You can't even see any wreckage of the plane. It's totally destroyed. And yet, a passport survives?
That's right. Just a couple of blocks or so from the World Trade Center, there's this passport in fairly good condition of one of the hijackers. It didn't happen to be, you know, the average John Doe. It was just our good fortune to be the passport of one of the hijackers, sort of like the hijackers in their cars right near the airports they took off and left all of their extremely incriminating material so that we could find them really quickly, just like so we could find Tim McVeigh really quickly after Oklahoma City. And then in Pennsylvania, never mind the 8-mile trail of debris, supposedly this plane took a steep nose dive intact and right into the ground, big incineration, even the black boxes, you can't tell, some things on voice recorders, they're incinerated. However, this little paper plastic passport survives, and the FBI, for a short time, you can't find it now, for a short time, put a picture of the passport on its website, and I downloaded it, but now you can't get it. And once again, this amazing incident of this passport, not of, you know, John Doe or Jane Doe, but one of the hijackers survives. And so we're supposed to believe all of this happened just by accident, I guess.
And I think the one point that you made was so beautifully. I mean, here is Muhammad Atta. He's going to go on a suicide mission. He's going to kill himself and everybody on the planes. So he carefully packs his suitcase before going on the trip. And then, of course, he leaves the suitcase and all of the other incriminating evidence in a rented car at the airport. Now, you would think he might have parked it on a side street. You think he might have not bothered to pack a suitcase when he's going on a suicide trip. But he does all of those things along with all of the incrimination so that everybody will know exactly what happened. And the question is, what's wrong with this picture?
Right.
How many people pack their bag before they go on a suicide trip?
Well, not only that, he could have taken it on the plane with him if he wanted to, but he didn't even do that. He leaves it nearby so that, I guess, if for some reason his plane is delayed and another plane takes off, accomplishes its mission, then all of the airports are closed down and there's a big scurrying around while people are kept on the plane so they can't get off, so that we could find his baggage really, really quickly and get on the plane and nab him, I guess. But, you know, that's incredible.
Well, you know, somebody never said, never underestimate the gullibility of the American people, especially when they're told over and over and over again.
That's true. In fact, I forget who said it, but years ago there was a famous philosopher said, if you just tell them a lie over and over again, pretty soon the gullible American public will believe it. But
I think that was Goebbels, and I think he was talking about.
That's right. Yeah, he did Goebbels. Say that.
What Hitler said was it? No, one of the other philosophers says it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, if it's repeated often enough, people will believe, and that's really what it's all about.
In fact, Madame Blavatsky said the more ridiculous, the better.
Well, she probably had heard about this scenario, or maybe she saw it in a seance. I mean, she died about it in the early 1890s, but she was a Luciferian, and she's really the godmother of much of what's going on today, and many of the occult organizations which dominate modern-day America.
Yes, and to some extent, while it may not be a seance, it could be planned in the extent, and I don't want to digress too much, but just for 15 seconds here, Robert Hugh Benson, when he wrote that book, Lord of the World, in which he was talking about, this was like 1907, he said in 10 years, 1917, the communists will come to the fore of the revolution, 1989 would be the Western scheme of free trade, and ministers of euthanasia around 1998, like Jack Kevorkian. What he had been with was his stepmother, her brother had been a founder of the Society for Psychical Research, and when he was a little kid, he probably was, around those people and listening into their discussions about their plans for the future. And so in his book, in the front of it, he says, I have to be very careful how I say this, and then he writes this futuristic book.
Well, of course, there's so much out there. In fact, I know you have read the transcript of the speech given by Dr. Dunnigan's comments on the speech
right.
given by Dr. Richard Day. Back in 1969, we outlined everything that would happen after that, and of course, even going into the background of how they would use terrorism and how they would ultimately perhaps use nuclear attacks on America just to bring the people in line to get them to be willing to give up their freedom and go into the New World Order. One of the most incredible things, incidentally, I have permission from the woman who did those interviews, Randy Engel, and we offered it. The transcript is called The New Barbarians, and of course we have a 4-tape set on The New Barbarians. You'll actually hear the interviews with Dr. Dunnigan, who in 1969 heard this whole incredible story, and then there's one of the interviews I did with Dr. Dunnigan as well, where he talks about this long-range plan that has been laid out for many years for exactly what's going on in the world today.
Yes, it's really incredible, and he, of course, was an officer with Planned Parenthood, Dr. Richard Day, and giving that talk to the people in the doctors in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And, back to the point we were just discussing, it's a matter of what we knew before September 11th, and one of the key points I've picked up, and I know you did too, from Kristen Breitweiser's testimony was when she said, how did our government agents know the details of a conversation between the terrorist hijackers a week before September 11th unless they were already being monitored?
Maybe just for our listeners out there who don't know who Kristen Breitweiser was, her husband Ron Breitweiser was killed in the South Tower, and on the 18th of September last year, she testified before the House Senate Joint Intelligence Committee of the United States Congress, representing the families of the victims of 9/11. Her testimony was, of course, totally suppressed and censored by the controlled media. That is my October newsletter, and any of our listeners would like a copy of that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV, or ask for our October newsletter. We'll send it to you. And one of the things Kristen talked about was these terrorists who, of course, a week before the attack, were talking on a cell phone, and yet our government knew exactly what they were talking about. And the question is, how could our government know exactly what they were talking about a week before the attack unless they were being monitored a week before the attack?
That's absolutely right. Following along on that, we're also supposed to believe that the CIA felt Mohammed Atta was important enough to monitor from January to June of the year 2000, but yet when he came over to the U.S. the very next month to go to flight training school, for some reason he was not important enough to be monitored. So there's a lot of questions there, and also relevant to the war against Iraq. One of the questions I bring up in the book is, why did our government settle 8,000 Iraqi soldiers after the first Gulf War around the U.S.? And possibly some of them might have been involved in Oklahoma City. And there are many other questions that are raised, not only before September 11th and the war with Iraq, but also immediately afterwards, like, well, why did the FBI hurriedly escort about 20 or so members of the bin Laden family in this country, in the U.S., quickly down to Texas and then over to the Saudi Arabian embassy in Washington and then out of the country very, very quickly at the same time they were detaining over 1,000 Middle Eastern males here for many, many months?
Well, I think people have to understand that we had infiltrated the Islamic terrorist movement. Now, they don't want you to know that, but of course we did. How do you think that they were able, within just a relatively few hours of the 9/11 attack, to begin rounding up this 1,000 or more Muslim people here in this country? And of course, recently it's come out, well, the reason we don't want to release their names is because we don't want Al-Qaeda to know which terrorist cells we had actually compromised and the people who were in the terrorist cells, as if somehow, you know, the terrorists wouldn't know that their people were arrested here in the United States. No, the thing is, they don't want the American people to know that they knew who the terrorists were, they knew where the terrorist cells were, and that's why they arrested them right after 9/11. Because if we knew that they had infiltrated the entire terrorist movement and knew about the attack, why, of course, that would be a criminal act, and people would demand that the culprits be tried and convicted. Because it's a federal crime, if you know there's going to be an attack or a crime, not to report it ahead of time. So they knew who all these people were. We had infiltrated that. If you want, I'm sure that Dr. Cuddy has that article out of USA Today, appeared only one time, saying we had infiltrated the Muslim movement here. We knew that there was going to be an attack on the World Trade Center that was planned, and we even knew approximately the date of that. Appeared one time and never again seen. But we fortunately do have a copy of that. What the American people don't understand is that that's why they arrested 1,000 people, held them, and then eventually sent them out of the country. They didn't want to try them. If they tried these people, why, of course, then they would have to admit they knew ahead of time. There's one of them now that came in the day before the attack. That was September 10th. They've just now transferred. They've kept him in prison all this time. And now, just this last week, he was transferred to a military prison. How did they know that this man coming in on the 10th of September 2001 was part of this whole terrorist movement? Because, of course, we knew everything about it. That's why there have been no major attacks in the United States since that time. We have infiltrated, in fact, in many people, I suspect, we even, in many respects, control this whole movement. And, of course, the question is, where is Osama bin Laden? Many people have felt that he was a CIA agent all during the 1980s. And maybe that's why we've just never been able to find him.
Right. Well, we know he was during the 80s. I put in my book September 11th how he had sent some of his operatives over here so the CIA could train them to go back as part of the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviets. So the question is, you know, to what extent how long afterwards he was. Same thing with Saddam. Saddam in the late 1950s. Was part of a six-member hit team, assassination team, trained and funded by the CIA as well.
I know what you're saying is right. What's your source of information on that? I want to see if it's the same as mine.
For Saddam?
Yes.
Off the top of my head, I'd have to get it. I think it's like MSNBC or a major newspaper. I can get it to you off the air.
Don't bother. No, I have a book called Unholy Babylon. It was written, I think, 1990 and 1991. That tells exactly the story you're putting out. If that's true, and Saddam worked for the CIA in the mid 1950s. Why would we think he ever quit working for the CIA? What do they say? Once CIA, always CIA? Maybe that's why the war went so well. Maybe that's why we can't find Saddam Hussein.
Right. And picking up on your last point, there's really two things. We know from Joseph Badansky, again, that we had known back in the 80s what the Iranians were up to in terms of training hijackers to grab planes and crashed them into buildings, and that the terrorists were in this country and they had safe houses and false identity papers and so forth. Now, the only way we could know that is if, even back then, we had infiltrated them or at least were monitoring them. And then secondly, regarding the current incident about September 11th, we know from FBI Special Agent Robert Wright and some others how he had indicated, he had written 3 months before September 11th that, quote, more American lives are going to be needlessly lost, end quote, at the hands of terrorists. Now, he said that 3 months before September 11th because he had been prevented from following the money trail, which he said would have led, would have led to the apprehension of these hijackers. And then, of course, a little bit later, and I put these quotes in cover-up, Robert Wright goes on to say that, in his opinion, you have a lot of people in our government, agents, FBI, and others, who, he says, do know or did know who terrorists were, but they didn't want to arrest them in advance, but they did want to have their names so they could grab them after the event occurred. And that's what Robert Wright said.
And that's exactly what happened. They knew it was going to happen. That's how they were able to get these people immediately afterwards. That's why, at least according to Kristen Breitweiser, in my estimation, and if you want to get her testimony, I don't know if it's still on the web, but we have it. It's included in my October newsletter of last year, and you can pull it off the web or give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send it to you, the October 2002 newsletter. Kristen Breitweiser quoted the New York Times saying that within 2 hours, that's 2 hours of the September 11th attack, the FBI was at the restaurants where the terrorists, the hijackers ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, at the schools where they flew. Within 2 hours, that is the most incredible police work of all time, unless, of course, they knew everything ahead of time.
Yes, and before, since time's about up, part three of my book does involve Iraq, and to that extent, it's very similar to what happened September 11th, in that you have various groups like the Project for the New American Century, another group, James Baker's Institute in Texas, co-authored with the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, reports that almost step-by-step say what would happen with regard to Iraq, even saying the war would be relatively short and relatively few people would be casualties there, and how oil played a part in it, and how Saddam just offered an immediate justification for the real desire, which was a permanent military presence in the Gulf. And so, again, I try to cover the war with Iraq as well as September 11th in the book Cover-Up.
And I think that's really so important. For anybody who doubts what Dr. Cuddy is saying, you go to the website, newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. And you'll pull down their 1998 letter to President Clinton by, of course, the members of this little group, the New American Century, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, William Bennett, you know, the author of the Book of Virtues. Of course, this little group that took over our government. And, of course, in 1998, they were calling for a war on Iraq. It was all decided long ahead of time, but they couldn't let the American people know that. And the only question is, how were they able to take over the Bush administration and put their people into all the key positions? But, of course, that's a question nobody wants to ask because nobody even knows that this little group exists. But go to their website, newamericancentury.org. They've got it all right there, or it's in our, certainly in our syllabus, the Iraq, the Untold Story. Well, we've got about 8 more minutes, Dr. Cuddy. What are a few more of the important issues you want to bring up?
Yes, and what you just said is important because a lot of people, when you say take over, say, oh, you know, you've got to be kidding, you know, taking over the government, this little group. Well, again, in the books and then in my expanded addendum, what I try to do is put it in their own words. And so, for example, Ted Koppel, who's certainly no right-wing conspiracy kook, as Rush Limbaugh might say, had a professor, Ian Lustig, on from University of Pennsylvania one night. And there, specifically, Lustig is talking about PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, and said this group, quote, now controls the White House. And Rush Limbaugh, who himself is a big supporter of President Bush, on his May 29th national radio show, he was talking about an editorial the L.A. Times had written called Temper the Course on Iran. And in there, Rush says, the L.A. Times may as well be saying that poor old Bill Kristol, who was chairman of PNAC, is running the administration from his editorial pages of the Weekly Standard, and he may be, for all I know, end quote. So even Rush is acknowledging that. An example of what he may mean is the Weekly Standard on May 12th, William Crystal writes an editorial saying, quote, "We must also take the fight to Iran with measures ranging to covert operations," end quote. And shortly after that, sure enough, the Bush administration puts out information saying that's exactly what we're considering, covert operations in Iran, and lo and behold, you have spontaneous student demonstrations there.
Well, in fact, Chris, these are not spontaneous demonstrations. I have no question at all that they're being put on by the Central Intelligence Agency. You don't get 10,000 students out spontaneously in a police state, which in a dictatorship, as they are in Iran, unless, of course, you go into the background, as you pointed out so well in the past, and you quote Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, where Colonel Schwarzkopf, General Schwarzkopf's father, had actually participated in toppling President Mossadegh in 1953.
Right.
And, of course, that was a CIA operation, wasn't it?
Yes. Alan Dulles gave General Schwarzkopf's father, who had been head of the New Jersey State Police, he had shortly retired from that, but he gave him about $10 million in a secret slush fund to train fighters to overthrow the government of Iran in 1953 because they had nationalized their oil, and we didn't like that. We've done similar things. I mean, our CIA, look what it did to Diem in Vietnam, so we're perfectly capable of some nasty things.
And, of course, they overthrew the Shah of Iran back in 1979 and brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power, of the best Islamic terrorist country more money could buy. And somebody just called and wanted to ask, if there were any members of the CFR or the Federal Reserve in the Twin Towers on September 11th, have you heard anything about that?
I have not heard that any of them got killed, no.
I haven't heard any either, but I can tell you, of course, certainly Senator Gary Hart, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, said on the 14th of September, addressing a group of CFR members in Washington, D.C. at an emergency meeting, where he said, there is a chance the President of the United States can use this disaster to create what his father talked about, and I think only one time, and that is a new world order. That was one of the most revealing statements I've ever heard, don't you think?
Yes, and there's two other quick revealing things. Donald Rumsfeld, who you said must be very prescient regarding the number of troops we need, maybe he's also prescient about North Korea, because in year 2000, he was on the board of a Zurich-based energy company, ABB, which sold two light water nuclear reactors to North Korea. And lo and behold, we're now surprised that this member of the Axis of Evil is possibly building some nuclear bombs. That's number one. Number two, we have the tragedy of September 11th, and many, many of the victims' families have sued Prince Sultan, the Saudi defense minister, Saudi Arabian, a defense minister, in $1 trillion of lawsuits, and coincidentally, Prince Sultan and the Saudis are being defended against these families of the victims by Baker & Botts, the law firm of James Baker, who I just mentioned, had this co-authorship with the CFR of this plan. One report a year before September 11th about the Caspian oil and so forth and removing Saddam, and the second report months before the attack on Iraq, talking about few casualties, wars over quickly, and the post-war, post-conflict events that could take place regarding oil.
And I think our listeners should know that James Baker III was President George Herbert Walker's Bush Secretary of State, and of course he was the President George W. Bush's lawyer in Florida when they were arguing over whether or not George Bush would become the President of the United States. So the President's lawyer is defending Prince Sultan, the Saudi Arabian, who is involved in financing Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 terrorists, both before and after 9/11. And the Saudis are still funding Al-Qaeda. They have to have money, and it's coming from Saudi Arabia. If you haven't read the book we carry, Hatred's Kingdom, going into the background of Saudi Arabia and how they finance Hamas and how, of course, they have financed this whole Islamic terrorist movement. Hatred's Kingdom, you need to get that. It's an important book. Out of print, we have the only ones that are available right now that I know of. And, of course, isn't it strange that the president's lawyer is defending the people who are financing the terrorists? What's wrong with this picture?
Well, he's also a high-level, I think, maybe board member of the Gorbachev Foundation. He just happens to be that. And also, he was the one when Secretary of State during the first Gulf War said that war was about jobs, 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 which really means oil, oil, oil. And I put one of the quotes from President Bush and Brent Scowcroft when Colin Powell is trying to say, well, maybe we can negotiate, and they say, no, we've got to have this war. So I'm wondering if the current President Bush, quote, had to have this war with Iraq as well.
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions. We could go on for another couple of hours, but I want to thank you so very much. Our guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy. You need to get his books, especially the latest one, Cover Up. You'll see the emblem of Admiral Poindexter's Total Information Awareness Department that wants to spy on everybody. And, of course, it's a symbol you see on the back of the dollar bill, the Luciferian symbol. You'll actually see Dr. Cuddy fortunately put it into his book. You want to get his books, Secret Records Revealed, The Globalist, Now is the Dawning. Give us a call and ask for one of the catalogs where you can get a list of all of Dr. Cuddy's books. They're must reading if you want to know what's going on. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye, and give my best to your mother. Bye-bye.
I'll do it. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I want to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent primarily on the people out across America who listen to our programs and believe in what we're doing, so that we will be able to continue doing what we're doing and reaching out 5 hours every weekday and then to 36 or 35 different stations on the weekend with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, hope that you go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can pull down our programs, where you can certainly pull down our newsletters and copy the newsletters and give them to other people. Try to get them to begin to question what's going on. The problem is what we're doing is challenging everything people believe. If we could just simply get people to understand that America is not a democracy, it's a republic. If they could begin to understand that their educational system has not been education, it's been indoctrination, we're in real trouble in America. And, of course, behind that are those dark spiritual forces that come against any nation that turns against God. And America has turned against God. We ask you to pray for our country. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, my ministry, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday when we'll be back again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Good evening, Dr. Stan, back here again, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But now we ask you to hold your calls for a few minutes because we have with us on the line really one of my favorite guests. In fact, what a privilege it is tonight, first of all, to have Dr. Dennis Cuddy and then to have John Loeffler of Steel on Steel. John, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, you should have had us on together. Then we could have really ripped up.
Well, of course, it would have been fascinating. But, you know, did you have a chance to listen to my talk with Dennis?
No, I've been out running around tonight.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, then we can certainly just to get all of your views and on so many things. As you know, John does a program called Steel on Steel. Some 12, I don't know. How many years ago was it you gave up?
13, believe it or not.
13 years ago, John and his wife, Carol, and with a couple of children, and certainly not anything more than simply faith in the Lord, he gave up a good job, a regular paying job with television, with the major networks, and set off to try to educate the American people about what was going on. Then they moved over to Denver, and for a time he was the voice of conservatism and Christianity and on a major station there in Denver. And then, of course, they changed. I guess somebody came in and took over, and they didn't like what he was talking about, why he was against the United Nations. He thought that it was a plan to take over the United States and take over the world. And so eventually, of course, John, for time, was up in Idaho working with Chuck Missler, and now, of course, he has his own network, and his program Steel on Steel is heard here on KFER every Wednesday evening from 7 to 8. And if you don't listen to it, you need to, because it's really one of the high points of my week. in fact, I still remember the opening of the last program, talking about the sheep, and then that bleating, it was, something of the sort, and that was a great program. Well, what's your take on what's going on in the world today? Because I think that there are a lot of people out there who see something's going on, but they're not quite sure what it is. And there's so many conflicting reports, and see, the market goes down, and now the market goes up, and gold goes up, and now gold goes down, and we won the war in Iraq, but our boys are getting killed over there, and the people are in the streets welcoming us, and now a lot of the people are you know, taking pot shots at our boys, and we had weapons of mass destruction there, and then we can't find the weapons of mass destruction. And Saddam Hussein is the most evil man in the world, but we just can't seem to find him. We don't know if he's dead or alive. And, you know, and there's certainly Osama bin Laden, the wicked Osama bin Laden. We just haven't been able to find, but boy, we're sure going to get him sometime, dead or alive. And what's really going on in the world? What's your take on it?
Boy, you want that in a nutshell?
Yeah, 30 words or less, please.
Well, I would say the first thing that happened is between September of 2000 and September of 2002 will probably be recognized as history looks back as passing through a tremendous paradigm change in which lots of rules all changed, but very few people really grappled with the significance of it as we passed through it. And typically when you go through what's called a paradigm change, most of the people are very busy trying to compare things under the old paradigm. And that's why they don't recognize, and the majority of people always get it wrong. They always arrive late, wondering what's going on. That's why they always make the wrong moves in the stock market, because they're always at the bottom end of the curve every time something goes on. But the paradigm change started, if you remember, in the 1990s, we went through the what was called the Oslo peace process. And as long as nobody put the hard ball questions on the table in that process, we were okay. Everybody could all have smiley faces and talk about the peace process and have the tremendous hopes for the future of both Palestine and for Israel. Now, everybody knew that once the hard issues got thrown on the table, now these hard issues are the ultimate fate and the control of the city of Jerusalem, the settlements in the West Bank, and the final frontiers and the right of return of refugees. Once those got thrown on the table, we all knew that the thing would fall apart. and the smiley faces would go away. But as long as we didn't throw those on the table, everybody was happy to go along. And if you notice, most of the Arab world behaved itself. Terrorism died down. They wanted to see how much they could get for nothing. Finally, in August of 2000, somebody threw the stuff on the table, and it fell apart rather rapidly. And then in September of 2001, we had the Intifada, which was supposed to be this spontaneous, unplanned uprising, which really in reality was more of Yasser Arafat. It's all Arafat has ever known how to do. Why does the U.S. State Department, well, I know why, but I mean, it, from a reasoning standpoint, why does the State Department always put former terrorists in positions of trust? I'll never know. But they do, and that's what it is. So the Intifada came up, and that's where public opinion began turning very much against Israel, because as Israel tried to deal with the situation, every night we were sort of bombarded with, you know, Israel does this, Israel does that. Not a lot of accurate information. At the same time, because of these measures, the Palestinian economy just collapsed. And in essence, they shot themselves in the foot, and a year later were complaining that the pain was so bad in the course of this uprising. See, the gamble was that the Intifada was going to draw huge amounts of world sympathy, for which Israel would then have to cave in line. Now, what upset that is the fact that I don't know how much Arafat and bin Laden were talking to each other. But then the next year, September of 2001, of course, everyone knows what happened then. And by September of 2002, we were talking about going into Iraq. That is the time of the major paradigm change. Everything that happened in the 90s collapsed, changed radically. And the new rules that are being written right now are radically different than rules which have been written before. And that's what I don't think anybody has really come to grips with at this stage of the game, that the game is not being played the way it was before. Now, as far as the invasion of Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction and all of the things there, that was a ruse, Dr. Stan. You and I both know about the Project for the New American Century. Cheney and Wolfowitz Incorporated, they intended to go back into Iraq long before President Bush ever came to office. Wolfowitz was pounding that drum all the way through the 1990s. And suddenly we go in, and the ultimate goal now, let's zoom out to the bigger things. We all know there's been a push for global governance, at least anybody who's been sitting and reading the documents. Even the latest edition, well, it's not the latest now, there's a later one. One of the previous edition of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, is talking about the collapsing and the resurrecting of the United Nations. And we picked up on that last November. And here it comes out in plain print. And they're still talking about a new world order. That phrase was used again in this article here. So they're all talking about global governance. It's just a question of who's global governance. We've known for some time, and remember this is a whole multidimensional type of thing. It's not just one item. We've known for some time that under the new concept of global consensus and tolerance, three religions would really have to go or be co-opted, and that was Quranic Islam, Orthodox Judaism, and Biblical Christianity. Those things would have to go. They just would not be tolerated in the new order of things. Because the new order of the day is the fact that everybody has to get along so that commerce works and this whole new planned global society will work. Without it, it's not going to work. Well, after 2001, it was real easy to pick on the Islamic world because, let's face it, radical Islam really was a threat. They really were mad at us. But that was used as a ruse to go into Iraq. This is what I call the old bomb and switch maneuver. And the establishment, the Bush administration, the neocons that are there, never successfully established any connection between what happened on 9/11 and Iraq. That link has been tenuous at best. Now, I believe there are some links, but that's because all of the Islamic world has links with each other on all sorts of things anyway. But that was a ruse to go in. There are all sorts of reasons why. Number one is to stabilize the Middle East. An unstable Middle East is not going to cut it in the new plan of globalization that's going on. And so by enforcing ourselves in there, that was the goal. Number two, there is an oil issue that's involved because we're almost at the end of cheap oil. We're not out of oil, but we're out of cheap oil. And thanks to a lot of environmentalism, most oil exploration and new oil rig dropping has virtually quit. So as a result of that, we're almost at the end of cheap oil. And everybody knows that in less than a decade, there's going to be this horrible crunch for oil. Everybody's going to be competing to get cheap oil. Now, we could be exploring other methods of energy, but we've eschewed that for a long time. So that was factor number two. One is globalism. Factor two is the issue of cheap oil. Factor three is the forcing different religions to begin conforming to the new global standards of tolerance and diversity and things of that nature. And there's more than that. Factor number four really took place here in the U.S. I just saw a recent Barna poll, and I was horrified at how many Americans are willing to just cash in on all their liberties. But what has really just flabbergasted me in the midst of this, Dr. Stan, is, you know, for years we kept hearing about how the conservatives were strict constructionists and in the interpretation of the Constitution. And it's the conservatives that have been cheerleading the destruction of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. I mean, just cheering it on and branding anybody who doesn't agree with it as being either anti-government bigot or radical left-wing anti-hate America type of person. This has really flabbergasted me. And a good part of these are what I call the Council on National Policy crowd, along with a lot of the religious right, who really should know better, if you pardon my saying so. And I say that with a lot of disgust, because for a long time I thought they were the one light that was trying to stand on something solid, and now they've said we should just cash it all in. So to a large degree, a lot of the liberals are getting it right. I mean, certainly the libertarians are getting it more right than either the conservatives or the liberals. But the liberals, some of the liberals are getting it right, but I would say for the wrong reasons. They keep trying to see it through the old filters of big capitalist business and imperialist America, all those terms which came out of the Vietnam War. And there really is a radical leftist element that are very Marxist-driven, funded by Marxist organizations, driving a lot of this protest. But there's legitimate dissent on all sides of the issue as well. And the reason the liberals are getting it right is because they're right. We are putting things in danger. But what they don't realize is they themselves, in demolishing the Second Amendment to the Constitution, never dreamed that once they had allowed the devil to trample that one down, that he would whip around on them and come back on them. And that's the biggest danger. You know, I just wrote an editorial piece for newsofviews.com that I don't even know if they've got it posted or not, but I patterned it after Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and using the phrase, shall long endure. And I listed all of the things that I thought were endangering freedom, and terrorism is not one of them. And those are the things that maybe sooner or later that maybe we should talk about tonight, because freedom is really definitely under attack. Freedom was not under attack on September 11th, 2001.
We're going to remember what George Bush said, and it all came upon us in a single day, and night fell on a different world, a world in which freedom itself was under attack. And those were really very, very profound words, because that's exactly what happened. But freedom isn't under attack from the Islamic terrorists. Oh, yes, there is a threat from Islamic terrorism. And yet, you know that since, of course, what happened on September 11th, 2001, there's not been one major Islamic terrorist attack in the United States, other than the anthrax, and I don't believe that came from the Islamic terrorists. After all, Dick Cheney knew what was going to happen or suspected it, because he and his staff went on Cipro on the evening of September 11th. But they didn't bother to warn the rest of us that we should be concerned about an anthrax attack, but they were concerned enough to go on themselves. But, of course, September 11th then has been used as a justification for the Office of Homeland Security. That's like the Schutzstaffel, the German Gestapo, that in the, of course, the USA Patriot Act, the Model Emergency Health Powers Act, and all the other things that are going on, certainly the Office of Total Information Awareness, Admiral Poindexter, and of course they've changed the name, but they're still doing the same thing, collecting dossiers on every law-abiding American citizen, but really not very concerned about the terrorists.
It's very true. All of these things were ready to go early on, so they had nothing to do with 911. You look, and like for right now, let's show you how you always ask whether agendas are afoot or not. You ask, what would a reasonable person do? And if a reasonable, that's what Dr. Dennis Cuddy did on his most recent book. You know, he asked, what would a reasonable person do in case of Saddam Hussein, say, went under attack?
You're talking about, of course, his most recent book, Cover Up, which incidentally is carried here at Radio Liberty.
Well, let me give you an example. For a long time, there have been very quiet conversations going on. You pick up a little bit here, a little bit from a think tank there, of the merger of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Now, we're talking about, first of all, an economic union. Second of all, we're talking about a political union, ultimately. There were conversations that have gone on between the U.S. and Canada in Ottawa, and all of a sudden, about 2 years ago, Presidente Vicente Fox of Mexico comes out and says, we need to have further economic and political union between the U.S. and Mexico. Again, what astounded me, just as when George Bush Sr. used the term New World Order, what shocked us was not the fact that he used it, but that he used it in public. And it was the same deal there. Now, the reason why we are not doing the most logical thing in controlling our borders is because that would interfere with the bigger design of the unification of Mexico and the United States, which economically is underway right now. Virtually the northern half of Mexico is part of the United States economic arena. We were promised in NAFTA, if you recall, that this was going to improve business. Instead, it did exactly what we knew it was going to do. It was going to flush jobs south of the border. It was not going to do anything to improve free trade. The trade isn't free. You don't need a 20,000-page agreement to say we're going to have free trade. You do, however, if you're going to heavily regulate how and when things come across the border. So right now, the southern border is an open sieve for all of these terrorists to come across. We know that hundreds of people come across every night. Some of the groups are dressed in camouflage outfit with automatic weapons, bringing in, obviously, drugs, but heaven knows what else. Now, a common-sense man, you know the one thing the Constitution says the federal government is supposed to do is to provide for the common defense. So it would seem only a reasonable act to begin guarding our southern borders. But we refuse to do that. We will pat down people at airports, and now we want to put in the next generation of x-ray devices, the backscatter x-ray devices, which literally look through clothing, and you're standing there looking at a naked body so it can expose anything there. Well, good luck. But that's why we know that there are other agendas afoot, because this planned regional globalization and economic unification of North America has been in the works for a long time, ever since it was first broached by the Club of Rome.
And, of course, really, I honestly think they intend to unify the entire, you know, the Western Hemisphere from the Aleutians to the tip of Tierra del Fuego. I mean, that is the real, that's what this fast-track legislation is really all about. That's why they had to get that through. But they don't want the American people to realize that, of course, this is going to be great for business, but business in Mexico and in Guatemala and a business down in Honduras, but not for business in America. We have already, since George Bush got in office, we have lost 2.7 million industrial jobs. This didn't happen by accident. It's all part of the great grand plan. But, of course, we've got to keep our attention focused on what's going on overseas and on the wicked French and, you know, renaming our fries Freedom Fries rather than French Fries. We've got to keep the public diverted so they won't understand what's happening. And, you know, what's even more disturbing, John, is a lot of people don't even care what's happening as long as things are good here. You know, the market's going up, things are looking better, there's more optimism. And yet, of course, the job market is disappearing, profits are down, unemployment is up, and yet, of course, people are beginning to get more optimistic. Based upon what? Upon the psychology of looking at the stock market and seeing going it up, even though it's totally manipulated, even though, in violation of all of the laws of this land, the Federal Reserve, working with the banks and with some of the big brokerage houses, are actively manipulating the stock market because it's good for the psychology of the American people.
Right. And they're talking about new and more creative and innovative ways of rescuing the economy. What that means is this latest, what was it, a 0.5% interest drop again this week, is about as far as they can go without wrecking the bond market. If they go much lower, all sorts of paper instruments are going to be severely damaged by this thing.
But, we've lost 30%, over 30% of the value of the dollar in reference to the euro here in the last year and a half.
Right.
That's why they're telling us, well, don't go to Europe this for your vacation. Stay here in the United States and enjoy it. Why? Because everything is be so much more expensive over there, it'd just blow your mind. So, and as long as you're not traveling outside of the country, you don't understand the significance of the drop in the American dollar.
Right, and that's also for trade purposes. They're actually tanking the dollar to improve the trade deficit. All of this stuff, Dr. Stan, the trade deficit, the Fed, the whole bit, is all the result of what happened on Jekyll Island and what happened in Bretton Woods. and yet it's talked about every night on the news as if this is the normal part of the economy, when anyone who looks at it, say, with von Mises glasses, Ludwig von Mises, and his understands that it's all artificial. It's all funny money. It's all funny exchange. It's all pulling and tugging levers. You see, what you were talking about, the jobs going offshore, our manufacturing sector is going offshore. We were told that, oh, yes, that's okay, but the U.S. is becoming the leader in the information age. Well, let me clue you, those information jobs are now going to Singapore and India. We're leaving ourselves with virtually nothing. But that was part of the goal. Don't you remember back at the UNCED conference in Rio de Janeiro? That was one of the, at the United Nations conference. That was one of the core essence ideas, was that the U.S. economy had to, could not be allowed to be strong for the sake of saving the environment. We had to ratchet the U.S. economy down to the level of a third world country and transfer the wealth of the United States to other countries. And, of course, the UN at the time wanted to be the manager of that wealth transfer. This was all discussed over a decade ago and discussed publicly if you just went and listened to what these people were saying, but the media didn't talk to you about it.
And
you know?
The average American has no grasp of what's going on, other than the fact that, gee, I wish I could play basketball and get a $100 million contract right out of high school.
Well, I mean, and they don't care. You know, the old question is, you know, are Americans ignorant, apathetic? Well, frankly, they don't know, and they don't care.
You know? Well, I mean, our job is to try to make them. You know, of course, my whole approach to doing talk radio would be that of the income of the life insurance salesman, because one of the first things you have to learn when you're selling life insurance is you've got to make people realize they're going to die. I mean, who'd want to buy life insurance if you weren't suddenly aware of the fact you might die and leave your family with no protection? Once you can convince somebody they're going to die, then, of course, you can sell them a life insurance policy. Well, I think that what we do is perhaps even more significant. We're going to try to teach people they've got a problem, and it is going to affect their family. And, of course, they may very well lose everything that they have economically. They may lose their freedom. They may lose their lives, and their family may lose their lives and what lies ahead of us if the American people don't get involved. And all we ask is them to look at the facts and see what's try to see and understand that they've been brainwashed by the educational system, by the media, and by our leaders who do not want the public to realize that the real goal behind everything going on today is a new world order and a new world religion.
Yeah, and we didn't think those up either, by the way. Those are not our terms. You see, that's real hard sell. Americans have already been programmed that when you hear that term, you're supposed to knee-jerk and say, oh, well, that's conspiracy theory. I go, well, you know, it's not really a conspiracy. It's a pretty open agenda. You just have to know where to look to find it, you know. You won't find Dan, Peter, and Tom talking about it, but it's pretty much out there. Like I said, in the Council on Foreign Relations, the latest, previous publication, they're talking about the New World Order. When they're talking about remaking of the United Nations, it's time. It's the end of a grand experiment. It failed. So it's obvious that there's another agenda that's afoot.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things is, if you look back 3 months ago, 4 months ago, France and Germany were our allies. Suddenly, France and Germany have become almost our adversaries. And now France and Germany are drawing closer to the Russians. They're going to take in, I think, 8 or 9 of the Eastern European countries here into the European Union. And, of course, eventually it's going to include Russia. It will be the greatest economic powerhouse in the world. It will dwarf America's economic capacity. What they're doing over in Europe now is, of course, making hard decisions. They're taking on the unions. They're going to cut back on the pensions and on all the welfare benefits. And they're going to make their economy lean and mean to make it so competitive that America, you know, is going to be in real economic problems. And, of course, if their euro ever replaces the American dollar as the reserve currency for the world, we'll no longer be able to export our inflation, and it'll return home with disastrous results.
It'll return home with a screaming vengeance, because about half of our money supply is held in foreign hands. And what that means is that if people suspect that the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, they will be dumping it as fast as they can. And what you can probably expect when that happens is for the president to suddenly issue an executive order slamming that window shut, making it impossible for those dollars to come back. and they will most likely circulate around the world, having value of their own, et cetera, et cetera. Very much as the euro dollars did. The euro dollars got trapped overseas when Nixon slammed the gold window shut. You know, I always remind people, I say, you know, when everybody's up there making promises about this and Social Security and all of that, it is really sobering to remember that no government in the world, including ours, has ever kept its financial promises to its people, ever.
Well, our producer, maybe our producer would like to call in, but she was telling me that Pete Peterson was on television on CNN the other day. Maybe it was, anyway, one of the television programs, talking about the fact that there is no Social Security fund, there is no Medicare fund, and that we are going to have to get the American citizens to work longer and harder, or the whole retirement system that we've been promising them was so secure for all these years is going to collapse. Now, for our listeners, Pete Peterson is certainly one of the most important men in the entire world. For many years, he was the a chairman of one of the major, I think, the Lehman Brothers, or one of the major Jewish banking concerns, and he's a Greek, so it has nothing to do with ethnicity. He was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now he has the Blackstone Group. But he is the man who tells other people what to do. If I was going to say, I mean, who runs the world, Pete Peterson would be one of them. Usually in the background, but more recently he did make some statements saying, you know, the only way we're going to be able to make Social Security work is people are not going to have, well, maybe Jeannie would like to come on the line and tell us a little bit more about it. Jeannie, why don't you call in on the and tell us what Pete Peterson was saying, something to the effect that people are going to have to work till at least they're 70 to retire, or the whole system is going to just collapse.
When you realize it, think about it, Dr. Stan, is that thing going to fly politically?
It doesn't matter whether it flies politically or not. Certainly, you know, the problem that we have is that if there's no money, why, they're going to have to do something. Jeannie doesn't know how to call in. Jeannie, why don't you go to line 3 and dial line 1, and then, of course, I'll pick you up on line 1. How's that? So anyway, she was really remarking about how this thing, how incredible this is, actually, to hear, you know, Pete Peterson talking about how Americans are going to have to work till 70 years. Of course, I've always said we could make Social Security work, no problem at all. If we put the retirement age to 84, there'd be plenty of money there.
That's true, but, you know, the bottom line is people are going to begin. What I'm saying is, I understand the financial part of it, but as you talk about the Americans who don't understand what's going on, these people, especially the baby boom generation, are all putting into this fund, assuming that they're going to retire at XYZ age and be entitled to this stuff.
No,
they will be the largest voting block when we get to that point, larger than the people behind them. This is not going to fly very well. I don't care about any economic reality.
All right, let's see if we've got... No, I guess we don't have Jeannie. Jeannie, why don't you just come on in here? We'll put you on the microphone. Anyway, it may not fly very well, but I think we're going into a crisis situation.
Right.
And I think that when there's a crisis, why, the people will look to our leaders to solve their problems. And
yeah,
after
they,
all,
they will
if those of us who are older are already getting Social Security, so we're not going to have to worry. And the people who are very much younger, you know, are not going to be that concerned. Jeannie, why don't you just pull your microphone over and tell us exactly what you heard. But right now, we're going to have to just go to the break, and we'll be back in just a moment here to hear what Peter Peterson was telling the American people very subtly the other day. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Loeffler of Steel on Steel, and in just a couple of minutes I'll let him tell you how to get in touch with his ministry. But as long as Jeannie is in here, and she was working as our producer this evening, but Jeannie, tell us what you heard Pete Peterson saying on television the other day.
It was the most amazing program. Thursday evening he was on Lou Dobbs' program, Moneyline, And he was had a guest. His name was Pete Peterson. And they were talking about Social Security funds. And Pete Peterson said, well, I think the senior citizens, they're going to have to get used to working longer and getting less money. And what the plan is, I've actually looked at a script that he wrote about 5 years ago also, is they're going to ratchet up the years that they're going to be working. So instead of collecting Social Security now, the at 62 or 65 years, 3 months, they're going to ratchet it up to about 68 to 70 years. That's when you're going to start getting your Social Security money. He says the senior citizens, they just have too much leisure time, and it's time that they work longer and harder, and also they're going to take the benefits down about 50%.
My goodness, I get up at 6 o'clock every morning. I work until 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock every night. I can't work much harder than that. I'm a senior citizen.
Listen to it, but what bugs me is listen to the arrogance of these people.
Well,
okay.
Because these are the elite, John. These are the people who are so much far superior to you and I. These are the people who run the world. A former CEO of Lehman Brothers, head of Blackstone Corporation, former chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. When Pete Peterson speaks, everybody should be listening.
It was interesting watching his eyes. If you've ever studied neuro-linguistic programming, you watch where the eyes go, depending if they're telling the truth, they're going back in time, or they're creating things in their mind. And Pete Peterson was telling the truth.
Oh, I think he was coming.
Oh, I think he was too.
And I think that we got to start telling the American people exactly what's happening. Thanks so much, Jeannie. Anyway, of course, we're in real trouble today. And the Social Security Fund doesn't have any money in it. We have a massive debt. I mean, George Bush is going to run up a $500 billion debt this year. And, of course, if you look and see what they're talking about, why, of course, they're talking about, well, it's only going to be about $400 billion, but that ignores all the money they're going to steal from Social Security.
Right. And in addition to that, what everybody needs to understand, well, you know, this is why I agree with you. We're headed to things. Oh, by the way, a number of people are solving the problem. They're just not filing returns, or they're cheating, you know. So people are already beginning to opt out of the system, so to speak, because they see the writing on the wall. They understand it's either that or feed themselves, and that's pretty much it, you know. And as more and more of this becomes aware, this is what I meant about this isn't going to fly politically. I don't care what the elitists say. People are going to just thumb their nose and say, hey, that's it. You guys promised us this. You bombed on it. End of story. We're out of here, you know. And what you really, what everybody needs to realize is this is just nothing but a case of massive fraud. and to me, it outrages because, you know, Dr. Stan, you and I put in most of our lives. Now, you're already retired. I'm not there yet.
I don't know what retirement's really all about.
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I were talking about the same thing. I mean, it's just like Carol says, we'll never retire. We just chug along. We love it, you know.
Well, you're lucky to have Carol, who will stick with you, and just as I'm lucky to have Barbara, you know, without whom I couldn't possibly do what I do.
Well, I agree with that. I guess what I'm saying is I'm finding people all over already, and you know what, I'm going to do a show very recently here on the Europeans are very upset. They're going to start imposing taxes on tax havens and things like that. See, the Europeans are going to have to come to grips, the socialist crowd there, before they do what you're talking about, are going to have to come to the grips that they have got they are such a mess right now in their own taxation system. That has to go away if they're to become prosperous. They have to release that. If not, the whole world is just sort of descending downwards into this economic morass. That's what I see happening, to be honest with you. And again, the guy on the street just doesn't understand it, because flip on the tube every night and all you get is babble coming out of the... It's so bad most of the time that I can't stand to watch it, because if you know the truth about what's happening, you watch them reinterpret all this stuff through the eyes of Keynesian lunatics. And you realize everybody's being handed a bill of goods. The goal is to keep everybody in the game to keep the system going. And that means you need to keep the suckers in the game long enough to keep it up. While the big guys, like the Pete Petersons of the world, he's not going to live hard on the hog. He's going to live high on the hog when he gets in his age and everything. But everybody else is supposed to keep on going. What they're doing is they're just hoping that X number of people die ahead of time and they can afford it. But the baby boomers put in all their life. I don't think this is going to fly politically. I think we're going to see when this stuff starts to break, and it will break. We're in this boom right now. It's not a false boom. It's a rally. And it's going to be sustained. It will be a sustained rally, I'm predicting, well through the elections of next year. But sooner or later, economic gravity has its way. When it blows out, you will see a revolution at the polls.
Yeah, but who are you going to vote for? Are you going to vote for Hillary? And because this is the thing, I mean, if you have a choice between George Bush and Hillary, it's going to be a tough choice. You know, I dislike Hillary very, very much. I mean, she would be a total disaster. But George Bush is the biggest spender we have ever had here in the United States. And, of course, if we continue along with this imperialistic line, we're going to end up with a blowback from China or from Russia or for somebody else. And as I read the writings of Dr. Day, what Dr. Day was talking about in 1969, I really believe that, of course, one of the ways to get out of this whole thing would be a couple of nuclear bombs in America, remove a certain part of the population, and so cow the American people, they will accept whatever they're told to do. And this is my fear. Well, we've got Monty calling us from Idaho. Hi, Monty. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right.
Go ahead. Speak right up.
Okay. Hey, I'm doing fine over here, but hey, I was wondering...
Can you talk just a little bit louder?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Go ahead, a little louder.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead. You sound like the fellow from Verizon. Go ahead.
Oh, there's something wrong here on my phone. But anyway, I was wondering what your take was. I figure you're pretty knowledgeable and your guest is too. What's your take in the next 6 to 12 months?
All right, fine. Well, let's get it from John Loeffler, and then I'll tell you what I think. But he's a lot smarter than I am. John, the question is, what's going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months, okay? 6 to 9 months.
You know, I'm actually trying to put that one together in my head, and I haven't quite succeeded.
Well, let me tell you, Monty, what I have heard from people who are a lot smarter than I am, who know what's going to happen. And they think that there's going to be an upturn in the economy, maybe not an upturn in the economy, but at least an upturn in the stock market. And, of course, this creates a false sense of optimism in the minds of the American people. Everything is perception, you have to understand. And he's talking about, he says that there's going to be market's going to go to 10,000 by October. And I wouldn't, I'll tell you that this man is so accurate it's almost frightening, because he has access to the people who know what's going to happen or manipulating the whole thing. And, of course, John Loeffler has suggested that maybe the market will stay up until the election next year. And I think that will be the determinant whether they want for George Bush to continue with the presidency or the people who really control things. Now, I'm sure George Bush wants to stay in the presidency, but he's not. He is simply a tool of the people who run the world. Maybe they want Hillary. If they want Hillary, why, they'll topple the economy and we'll end up with another Clinton in the White House. If they want George Bush in the White House, why, the economy will be good through November of the year 2004. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it'll be manipulated either way. Frankly, it's coasting along so nicely under George Bush, I don't think they're going to go the other way. We know that the move went towards Bush because Robert Rubin stepped down. That was sort of what Bob Goldsboro said the trigger would be, whether or not Democrats would continue in office or not. And sure enough, just before the election started, Rubin stepped down. And I think that's what we're headed for. Sooner or later, economic gravity is going to pull its own weight. The real question that you have to debate in your own mind is, how long can people keep this thing artificially up? Which is what's going on. The tragedy is, and what you need to understand is, let's zoom out, move it over the political range. Look at all of the breaches of the Constitution that are being cheered on right now by the conservatives. Remember what I said, I got this line from Sir Thomas More in Man for All Seasons. You know, when you knock down the law, suddenly when the law's lying flat, the devil whips round on you, what stands between you and him? And the answer is nothing. Now, there is something that the liberals on their side of the equation should have fessed up to a long time ago, and that's the fact that the Clinton administration was very corrupt. I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican, that's just a historical fact, and history will prove that correct. What happens if we have another Clinton in the White House with the same attitude, where many of the protections are now knocked down? In other words, we can arrest somebody in the name of national security, we can spirit them in the way of national security. We don't have to tell you where they are in the name of national security. We don't have to give them the rights of habeas corpus in the name of national security, and we can just keep you away forever in the name of national security. Put that under a Clintonian type of thing and like it.
Well, I think it's bad enough under a Bush administration. Maybe it'd be worse under another Clinton. I don't know. I mean, how much worse could things get? Well, of course, they haven't come and knocked on my door yet, so I guess they're not too bad, are they? Anything else, Marty, that you wanted to ask?
No, I'm just curious. I hadn't figured that they were going to try to keep the economy going for as long as that.
I really think that they will keep it going as long as they can, and they have amazing things that they can do. I mean, they can create money out of nothing and create artificial prosperity and manipulate the stock market and pour a lot of money into a lot of businesses to get them going. But, of course, eventually, as John says, the weight of gravity is going to get into trouble. And, of course, if the dollar keeps falling and the other countries start pulling their money out of our bonds and out of our stock market because they're not making any money and they've got to do a lot better in Europe than they do here, then, of course, we're in real trouble.
Especially if some foreign currency ties itself to gold, silver, or some other stable asset. That'll be the death of the dollar.
Okay, Marty, anything else?
Okay, just real quick, I just wonder, what are they going to do when everybody's out of work? I mean, unemployment is still going up. I mean, they can do this artificial hype here, but I mean, when everybody's out of work, they're looking around saying, well, what in the heck's really happening? You know what I mean?
But where are people going to look to? They're going to look to government to solve our problem.
Well, I understand, but I just think this weight's got to come down a bit quicker. I don't know.
Well, I hope that, I hope you're wrong. I don't have any, what are you saying, John?
Huh?
I thought you were saying...
Actually, I was doing a tie kick on my wife while I'm talking to you.
Fine. Well, anyway, of course, what I was going to suggest was I don't have any crystal ball. But the one thing I think is that we may have one more chance to get our finances in order. And if you can, this is the time to get out as much debt as you can, okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. And our telephone number... If you're out there across America listening to us, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for John Loeffler, why give us a call? And John, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with Steel on Steel?
Well, during normal business hours, of course, who in our business has normal hours, but that's beside the point. During normal hours, they can call us toll-free to get a list of our programs. If they want to call 1-800-829-5646, 1-800-TAX-JOHN. If we're not on the air in your area of the country, you can still subscribe to the tapes, or you can listen on the Internet. The shows are posted there 12 weeks back at steelonsteel.com. And we're a 90-minute-a-week intense news program. We cover as much as we can and try to give perspective. You know, I went back and checked our database. You know, the first time we mentioned Osama bin Laden on our radio program, Dr. Stan, was August 4th of 1996. So that shows you how much of a cutting edge we slice.
Well, you always are on the cutting edge, and I always enjoy your programs. It always gives me a smile when you come on, and you have such a wonderful means of delivery. I wish we could listen to you every day.
Well, I'd like to be back on the air every day. Carol would shoot me if I did it. So it was too much. There are just times that the problem that we have is, you know, I don't intend to. What I do is what we're doing here is we're setting up warning flags for people. They're not warning flags because people should freak out. I'm not selling guns, gold, or groceries or things like that. I really do care about the little guy, and I don't care whether you're liberal, conservative, or libertarian. I care about the little guy. What I try to do is say we're going to a positive destination by a series of infinite negative corrections. And the negative corrections now are getting critical because, you know, if you're navigating in tight circumstances and the waves are pretty high, you've got to make some very careful, calculated decisions as far as your economic life, your moral life, your worldview system, and just what you're going to do to get your family through it. It's not a panic opportunity. It's a time for just careful understanding the times, understanding what's happening. Because people can make money even in a collapsing market. You can survive and prosper even in bad times. I mean, one of the biggest traders of history, Jesse Lee Livermore, made $1 million in 1929 or more the day the stock market crashed. As a matter of fact, people were talking about how immoral it was for him to do that because he was making money off of other people's pain. But frankly, he had the smarts to see what was coming, and he positioned himself accordingly. That's all we're doing. Remember that the crowd is always running in the wrong direction because for the most part they either don't care or they're listening to those voices who are rigging the game. The game is rigged against the little guy, and the little guy keeps it rigged when he keeps listening to what the game masters are telling him. And so what we try to do on the show is say what is really happening here and how to have people plan accordingly to that. I don't have any intentions to panic, but it's going to be my prediction, it's going to be a wild roller coaster ride, and there are going to be jokers popping out of the deck every time you turn around. There will be unexpected curveballs coming at the U.S. I don't think at times the U.S. will know what hit it. I think I talk about frequently, I have a term that I made up called the GNI, the Global Nervousness Index, and I think the GNI is going to go up substantially because people are not going to quite be able to figure out what's happening. And that'll even include some natural disasters. I think we're going to see natural disasters in places where nobody expected them. That's almost the hand of God on the situation.
Well, you know, John, as I was driving home the other morning, after the Supreme Court had come up with their decision that they were going to strike down the sodomy laws there in Texas and basically legalizing sodomy all across America, and then they struck down another law having to do with prosecuting priests who had actually, molested, I suppose it was pedophiles, anybody charged with a sexual crime. There was a statute of limitations on it, and it got that struck down in California. So they struck down, basically means an awful lot of pedophiles and rapists and others are going to be released here in California. About 5 Kedwood cases will be, of course, reappraised, and probably these people will be released because of the Supreme Court's decisions. And, you know, I thought to myself, I wonder how God feels about this. I mean, after all, our laws, when this country was created, were based upon God's laws. And Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England were based upon the Bible. And that was the basis of American law back in 1790 and, for almost 100 years, after our country was founded. We were a Christian nation. Our laws were based upon Christianity. Now, of course, our government has turned against God. The courts are against God. 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices appointed by Republican presidents, the majority of them are going right along with the Clinton appointees and undermining the moral fabric of our society. And, of course, you commented about these natural disasters. Well, I believe God does rule in the affairs of men, and I believe God sometimes creates natural disasters to warn us that he's getting pretty fed up with the way things are going. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw lots of things of that sort happening. And first, as we remember from the Old Testament, how the Lord used the wicked Assyrians to attack Israel, to punish his beloved who had turned against him. Could that happen in America?
It's not even so. John McTernan, of course, has been applying that theory for a decade now in his book. And his observations of it. What people need to understand is when you have a country that's oriented towards the Lord, there's a lot of prayer, and the prayer does change things. God says the world is a fallen world, and part of that fallen state, part of the rebellion of mankind against God, results in the natural world, which has its what seemingly natural disasters and random things, like why do children die in bad circumstances and things like that. But at certain points with prayer, God does put his hand of protection over things. There were times during World War II when we shouldn't have prevailed. We just shouldn't have been. But I think it was prayer that took us through that. So Americans then got it in their head that this is the natural way. This is the way it is for Americans. We can slug it through no matter what. Well, I don't think so. And I think that's where it is not even so much as a punishment as it is simply the fact that the hand of protection is withdrawn simply because Americans don't seek it anymore. and they don't seek it because they're not seeking God in general.
Well, I think there's no instance in all history where a nation has turned against God, where God has not eventually turned against that nation. And that is my major concern, why I do what I do, trying to call people back to God and try to point out that we're involved in a spiritual battle. But, you know, it may not be a very popular message, but we'll keep doing it as long as God gives us the ability to.
Well, you know what? What really impressed me is we get down to the book of Revelation. And in the book of Revelation, it finally comes to the point that all hell is literally breaking loose on earth in forms of natural disasters, sores upon the people, plagues, mountains, comets falling into the ocean. And there's an interesting reaction on the part of the people. It shows what happens when people do not understand God. It says the people that are left, they do several things. The first thing they do is they curse God. They blame God for the disasters that are falling upon them, but they turn back to their sins, of which there were four principal ones, and there's witchcraft, fornication, theft, and murder. Isn't that interesting? So the first thing they do is they curse God for what's going wrong and turn right back to do the evil that they did before. They do not see the connection between the two. And that always amazed me. It was the same thing, if you remember, in the days of Elijah, when God withholds rain from the whole nation of Israel for 3 years because of the wicked rule of Ahab and Jezebel. And, of course, Elijah has to hide because Jezebel's after his hide as a result of what he did to the prophets of Baal. And finally he shows up after 3 years. I mean, Ahab and Jezebel have been looking all over creation for this dude to kill him for 3 years. He finally shows up, and Ahab says to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" You see, Ahab blames Elijah for the evil that Ahab himself and his wife have brought upon Israel. Now, that's an interesting reaction, in that evil people don't view their actions as being evil. They view them in their own best interest. You know, I've often heard that people will call Adolf Hitler a madman. Adolf Hitler was not a madman. He had his problems, like all people do, but we've had some geniuses that had problems, too. Adolf Hitler was a genius. He was a brilliant orator. I've spent some time listening to his speeches, and they're actually entrancing when you sit there and listen to them. And that's it. Now, Hitler didn't think he was doing any wrong. The Nazis didn't think they were doing anything wrong. And here we have a society today that doesn't believe there's any absolute wrong or right. Well, how will freedom ever be guaranteed? If we don't have absolute belief in a constitution, if we can't say that the constitution means what it says, strict constructionism, then what does it mean? What keeps its meaning from changing? And how will it not be changed in a way that suddenly leaves you and me unprotected? These are the kind of issues that are all tangled up together in this one thing. And that's why, even today, people will scoff. They want you. They, oh, this is America. This would never. Oh, no. They'd never do that. They can't tell you why they would never do that. Let me tell you why. When a country begins to coast, what it does is it coasts on the moral capital of the previous generations. And what I'm talking about is, let me give you an example. Say we had a family. You grew up in a stable home. You had a father and a mother that were good, and they took care of you. And you got married. Only your marriage was a little rockier. You had some kids, but then you got divorced after a big snarly divorce, and the kids are all emotionally scarred and damaged. Now, when you divorce, you have a home. You still have stable parents you could go back to or refer to. But your children do not have that. They come from a broken home. Then they have children, and all they know is broken homes. They have no, it's much, much, much more difficult for them to have stable homes. You see, the second generation was coasting on the moral capital of the first. And the problems don't begin to show up until the third and the fourth and the fifth and down to the seventh generation. And that's what Americans have been doing. They have been floating on the moral capital and the stability of a relatively moral society that was brought about by the previous system. And so, therefore, Americans have a very hard time understanding what it's like when all of that moral capital has been drained off, just like we've drained off the financial capital of the country. We've drained off the moral capital. The real funny part that I always run into, I gave a series of lectures up here in Coeur d'Alene about 3 years ago called Worldview Wars, and it took about 6 hours over the course of 5 nights. And I was talking about the Marxist origins of the teacher training program here in the country, which can very clearly be documented, coming from the Institute for Marxist Research in Frankfurt, Germany, which later changed its name to the Institute for Social Research, and then later set up shop at Columbia University, founded the B-Step program, which is the foundation for all teacher training, which includes Bloom's taxonomy. Blah, blah, blah. There it is. There's your whole chain. So I get done talking, and as people come up to talk to me afterwards, you know, we had an auditorium full, and these three guys, taller than I am, surround me, and I'm staring at all three of them, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what am I in for now? Let's see, what did we see at martial arts? What am I supposed to do when they do this? You know, I figure I'm in for it. And all three of them begin talking to me, and they're all speaking, Dr. Stan, with Russian accents. And they said to me, you are right about what you are saying about the American school system. We grew up in Siberia, and they left the Soviet Union right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he made to me the most poignant comment. He said, but what we don't understand is why you Americans have it here. We came here to get away from it. Everybody who comes from a country that has been through this, they recognize what we're going through right now. I had a pastor tell me who had grown up in Castro's Cuba. He said, I recognize what I'm looking at because that's what they did there. He said, but my children here, remember the next generation down, they don't recognize what they're looking at. They don't see the connections. And only if you've taken time to study it do you begin to understand this. And that's what we're facing right now. So I'm pretty well convinced that we're committed to the slide. That doesn't mean we have to get burned as the slide goes down. That's my analysis of it. But we are committed historically to these cycles, because historically, people simply forget what it was made them the great country that they were, and they just simply start the slide.
Well, that's, of course, why we're encouraging people to set up their institutes of the Constitution and to learn about America's Christian history, the most carefully kept secret in America today, as we were once a Christian nation. And if you're interested in setting up an Institute of the Constitution, why don't you call them at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. Because, of course, rather than just bemoan the problem, we want to come up with solutions. John Leffler, it's always a pleasure to have you again. Here is our, why don't you give your telephone number just one more time?
Sure, it's 1-800-TAX-JOHN. How's
1-800-TAX-JOHN. The IRS never forgets that. You shouldn't either. Bye-bye. Give my best to Carol. Thanks for being with us.
God bless, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, that was John Leffler. I hope you enjoyed our program with John. And this is the time when I need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you believe in what we're doing, if you believe there's a problem and you'd like to become part of our team in this epic struggle to determine if this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, remember, it's an expensive proposition to be on radio 5 hours a day and of course, 5 days a week and on our weekend programs. With your help, we're going to continue doing it, so pray for America. Pray for certainly our leaders, for our ministers. Pray for revival. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, we'll be with you again. Dr. Stan, goodbye. And I'm going to be doing the weekend program tomorrow on KSCO here in the Monterey Bay Area. I hope you'll be listening at noon. Good night. God bless.